Chong'o is considered to be the god of fire and the god of lightning, but also the god of justice. So in the event that I'm doing something that's either stealing or along the lines of stealing, and all of a sudden I get burned or something like that, that would be some manifestation that Chong'o is paying attention, and you know you're not supposed to be doing this kind of thing, right?
From KUER and PRX, this is Preach, a show about the messiness of faith. I'm Lee Hale. This week, my guest is Makinde Arirapo. He lives in Chicago and refers to himself as a custodian of Yoruban culture. It's this ancient West African culture and religion that spawned some practices you're probably familiar with, like Santeria and Voodoo. And Makinde's ancestors were Yoruban, but they were sold into slavery in the U.S., and their way of life was scrubbed away, forcibly replaced by a Christian worldview. His mother was raised Episcopalian and his father was raised Baptist. So in an attempt to reclaim this heritage, Makinde's father became a Yoruban priest and raised his kids in this tradition. And now Makinde is determined to keep Yoruban culture alive too.
Yoruba culture comes out of Nigeria, and it's an ancient African culture. The Yoruba people, Nigerian people, see religion and culture to be synonymous, so they don't generally frame it as a religion. But in short, the primary basis of Yoruba culture is ancestral worship. So it's the idea and concept that you pay highest homage to the family that came before you, and that those are your closest connection to the creator. And then the second level of worship within the Yoruba cultural pantheon is the idea that you have the Orisha. And the Orisha are deities. The numbers vary, the names vary, because now this culture has been disseminated throughout the world, primarily because of the transatlantic slave trade, right? In any case, so the Orisha are deities with natural force energies. So an example would be when we see a river, we say that that river is a manifestation of Oshun. And Oshun's powers, you know, or energies reflect on the ability to give birth and the ability to flow through the world and move through the world without disruption, things like that. So that would be the basic tenets. The creation story of the Yoruba is shortened to say this. We were all up in heaven. And, you know, everybody was just doing their thing. So let's just say me and you knew each other in heaven, right?
I love this, by the way. I love these kind of creation stories. So, okay, I'm in heaven with you. I'm there. All right.
So, like, you're staying down the block and we know each other, you know.
Wait, so we existed before this life is what you're saying?
Right.
Okay, this is cool. Because Mormons talk about this too. Mormons talk about pre-earth life and that you and I could have been friends before this life.
Exactly. So it kind of follows that same pattern, right?
I'm with you so far. Okay, so we know each other. We live on the same block.
The story goes that you would basically go to God. You would tell God, I want to go to earth. In Yoruba culture, we call it Olorun. Olorun has formed earth and is sending people down to get it together, right? And people start recognizing people leaving. So you go and you say, hey, I want to go.
You're saying, I want this. Was there an idea that it's going to be a challenge to go to earth?
Right. There is a task that you would take upon going.
This is so interesting. This is so similar to the way I was raised. Keep going. It's like blowing my mind. Yeah.
But the idea would be that, you know, God doesn't say no. And so God just simply asks, what do you want to do while you're there? So then you tell God, this is what I want to do, send you to earth, right? Now, here's the kicker is that, you know, we would imagine the transition from heaven to earth is probably a real serious exchange.
Yeah.
So the idea goes that when you arrive here on earth, you've actually forgotten what you told God you wanted to do because that transition is just, you know, it's a beast. So the process of living becomes you checking in with God to identify if you are on the chosen destiny that you chose when you arrived, right? Wow.
And you were raised in this, but it was your dad who decided he wanted this in his life, right? He wasn't raised with it, but he decided at a certain point he wanted to learn about this.
Yeah. So somewhere in the 60s, you know, you got a lot of political, cultural, revolutionary kind of information coming out specifically as it pertained to Black folks. And he and my mom, in fact, it was my mom first. They both were involved in various different groups. This is prior to them meeting. My mother was involved in a Pan-African group, which then led her down this path to learning more about Yoruba culture through some people that she met and worked with. But yeah, no, my mother was raised Episcopalian and my father was raised Baptist.
I was raised Mormon. That's the way I see the world. And I know that oftentimes when I come across a culture and a rich religious heritage like you're describing, it's easy to try to compartmentalize it, right? Or categorize it in a way that makes sense to me. And I don't want to do that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm just curious how you can describe, like, I mean, if I think about my home growing up, like religion was a part of everything, but especially was the focal point on Sunday, right? That was the day that we went to church. That was the day where we weren't supposed to like watch TV. Like that was kind of the way that my family worshiped. But like for you, was there a holy day or is this just kind of like an everyday thing? Like,
so this cultural perspective, right, obviously comes from Nigeria, and it's during the transatlantic slave trade that it gets spread to Brazil, Cuba, you know, North America. And so there are elements or forms of this particular cultural perspective that are actually practiced differently in different parts of the world, right? You have Condomblé, you have Santeria, you have the Dogon people, you have Paulo. So you have multiple forms of this. North America, in a lot of ways, was kind of the last place to begin what we call the restoration movement of this cultural perspective. So in a way, there is no traditional like church day, right? There is no like every Sunday or every Saturday for practice because it is really thought to be more of a personal practice within a community. Mm-hmm. But at the time that my parents were initiated and became priests and became what they would call a practicing priest, which is somebody who would consult other people in the community, organize events for the hierarchy, they did this thing called Shrine Day. It'd be the fourth Sunday of every month. But it didn't come from any particular religious tradition as much as it was an opportunity for them to organize the community in this way, right? All the kids would have to get up and clean and, you know, organize everything. People would bring food like potluck style. And the general format of Shrine Day would be either a visiting elder in the community would be on site and they would do an initial kind of talk up front. And then we would all sing songs, and each Shrine Day is dedicated to one deity. So you would sing all the songs to Oshun. You would dance to Oshun and you would give offerings to Oshun. And then we would all share in food and listen to music and just kind of party, really. And that would be what was probably the most consistent format of a formal gathering from a religious perspective, right? There is another element of Yoruba culture that it highlights what they call Ifa. And Ifa is how you essentially identify what your destiny is and check in to see if you are on the path to your destiny. So in Ifa worship, every 5 days, there's something called Orun Ifa, and that is when you go and you pray directly to your destiny. But again, that's individualized. That's not really a community event. That's you checking in personally.
Right. It's interesting, too, because you're talking about the influence and the offshoots. I think a lot of people would be familiar with Santeria, for instance, just maybe a name only, but familiar with it nonetheless.
Right.
Were your parents interested in practicing a type of Yoruban faith that predated all that? Were they trying to go back to kind of like the roots as best they could?
That is a good way to say it, man. Yes, is the answer. My dad and I went to Cuba in 2005. And every 2 years, they have this conference in different parts of the world, primarily in the Caribbean, Trinidad, Cuba. They hosted it in Nigeria once. They invite delegates from all over the world, right? It was the first time I had been in a room of the multiple different forms of faith. Whereas in my personal life, if I saw somebody in Chicago on a train with a head wrap on, you know, I just assumed like we was on the same wavelength, you know, like nobody else looks like that or dresses like that. So you must clearly be doing what I'm doing, you know. But in the Caribbean and Cuba, there's some very stark differences in how people practice. And something I wasn't prepared for until after it happened basically was that there is a general ownership thing that goes on with this cultural perspective. And people look at North America as in some ways not valid. The Cubans have kept the culture alive the longest without a disconnect. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, slaves here in America were not allowed to practice their traditional culture without severe punishment.
Right.
So a lot of it stayed underground and most of it disappeared. Whereas in Cuba, they found a way to keep the Orisha alive through the use of saints. So, you know, my previous example of Oshun might be Saint Agnes or something like that, right?
Oh, so they kind of made it palatable for like a Christian world so they could kind of do it undercover. Interesting.
Exactly. In any case, I say that to say that, yes, they wanted to find what they saw to be the real source. So my father's personally been to Nigeria and visited with some people there that educated him.
You mentioned initiation.
Yeah.
I think I saw a picture of you and your brother on Instagram. Was this an initiation that I'm looking at? It's you and your brother. This is taken a while ago, I think, right?
Yeah, I was like 12. We're in that red.
You have the red robes on and the headdress and the face paint.
Yeah, that was our throne day, which is when you're initiated. It's a 7-day ritual. And on the 7th day, you are presented to the community. That picture was taken right before we were marched outside in my backyard. That was the basement of my childhood home. And, you know, introduced to the community as having completed our initiation.
What's changed about you after the initiation? Are you like a contributing part of that community, or what's the change that happens?
It changes, man, over time. At that time, I was 12, so I was still living in my parents' house. And my father was very, very serious, active member. He was considered to be kind of the Midwest person to check in with, you know. So I did a lot of apprentice style work for him in the cultural perspective. And, you know, at that time, I'm not so sure that I had personally subscribed a belief system as much as I was following, you know, what I was supposed to do for my parents.
That's true of most kids, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Now, my brother, on the other hand, was 17. He had gone through his formidable stages and he was really approaching, you know, his adult life. And so the idea of some of the rules that come with these things were not as appealing to him.
What are the rules for living that come with the faith?
In your initial year of initiation, basically said to be reborn in a way. Previous existence has been stripped of you and you are now learning to be a person again in the world. So there are some pretty strict rules. I can't go through all of them because some of them are a bit of a secret society kind of nature. Mm-hmm. But some of the more obvious ones there that people see are you have to wear all white for 1 year. Mm. I mean, imagine being a seventh grader and, you know, you got all these friends that you've known since kindergarten and played ball with and, you know, hang out with and girlfriend, boyfriend with or whatever. And now you come just first day of school and you're dressed in all white.
Yeah.
But along with that, I had to wear a veil for the first 3 months. Wow. Anytime I went outside, couldn't go out after midnight. And the two tougher ones for me personally were I couldn't be touched or I couldn't speak at certain points. So there would be certain weeks where I would be on quote unquote silence, meaning I was not supposed to be speaking unless spoken to by one of my elder priests. So, you know, I'm a talkative guy and I'd be in school and, you know, I'd be writing little notes to people because I had to honor that discipline. And wow. I think, again, that's the interesting part is that there was nobody there over my shoulder, but it was suggested to me that not following these prescribed rules and not following these sacrifices, if you will, then why did we do all that work in the first place? So there was a bit of a personal ownership on the maintaining the discipline, which I'm sure you experienced in the Mormon culture the same way.
Well, yeah. And I'm also curious, are there more general like dietary or like sexual restrictions or like?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. No sex during your initiation year at all.
How about after just kind of like living your life?
No, my mom's description of it is probably the best I've heard, which is called, it's a living practice that you are a human being and it is expected that you will live as such. So every person does get prescribed a personal set of taboos. Mm-hmm. So one of mine is large bodies of water. I can't just willy-nilly go, you know, jump on a cruise line or whatever without doing some very specific kind of check-ins and, you know, small sacrifices to keep the energy supporting me. It's a big taboo of mine.
Is Lake Michigan count or is that small enough?
Lake Michigan does count. Yeah. Okay. No, I don't. I live a block or two away from the lake and I rarely visit it, unfortunately. And not because of that, but just more so because in the back of my mind over time, I've always lived close to water, but I've never played in water, so to speak. It's never been a playful element to me. Stealing is another one for me. I can't steal any small theft, any pin from the job or.
Okay, so you're talking about things that most people might not call theft, like they.
Right, but stuff happens to me, man. I don't know if it's magic or not. Like,
oh, fascinating.
I get caught immediately. Number one, I never get away with it. And two, it just limits my ability to move forward in spaces immediately. It's a very personalized set of information that you get upon what they call your ancestral roots reading, which is to say who you are and what you came to the earth to do.
Coming up, what happens when you're dreaming of being a football star, but your priest, who also happens to be your dad, says it's not your destiny to play football? More with Makinde Arirapo on Preach in just a minute. Hey, it's Lee. If you're looking for a new podcast, check out Sick, from WFYI and Side Effects Public Media in Indianapolis. In the 1970s and 80s, dozens of women went to a fertility clinic hoping to get pregnant. Decades later, their children uncovered the doctor's terrible secret. Reporters Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper take a hard look at the fertility industry, a doctor's abuse of power, and the lives he affected. Find Sick wherever you get your podcasts, and find more info at sickpodcast.org. Reconnecting with Yoruban roots is something that is getting talked about and written about more and more among young African Americans today. For some, it's a supplement to what are often strong family ties to Christianity. But for others, embracing Yoruban culture is part of an attempt to reject the Western religions that are seen as linked to the oppression of Black people in America. And as the number of people taking part in these cultural traditions increases, Bakinde sees it taking new forms.
When we were initiated, it was 94, pre-internet. And now this culture has kind of exploded all over the country. And it's even taking now more sub-forms. Now we see in North America several more quote-unquote sects, I guess, if you will, that are developing.
Just in your lifetime, like you were watching it happen.
Yeah, man. And so it makes it difficult because, again, like I say, there was a point at which if I saw anyone in traditional Yoruba dress or if their name, you can recognize a Yoruba name, right? It's like I automatically assumed we were going to be aligned. And now you can't do that. Now there's a lot of different people. One of the rituals that I had to go through to achieve initiation was a 24-hour thing. I mean, and then that led to a 7-day thing that led to a 1-year thing. And so I meet people now who are initiated and they describe their process as like a 45-minute thing. And it's difficult for me to understand.
You can say
that.
Back in my day, right?
But it's also just like, I also don't know what their lineage is. You know, again, this cultural perspective is heavily, heavily based on ancestral worship and individual community worship. So the priests that were my elders, those are all people with which I'm directly attached, and thus I am carrying their practice with me as well. And so that's the same as kind of expected of other folks. But yeah, so I grew up in that house, and over the next 10 years, anything that was related to the work of the temple, I had a hand in. When I moved out, obviously you get responsibilities of your own. So going to school, going to work, you know, limit your time. So I became less active. At that time, my personal practice really formed. That was really around the time where I made the choice to follow the cultural perspective.
What do you think is inspiring people to kind of branch out a little bit?
That is a phenomenal question that it's very difficult to answer because, first and foremost, obviously information just travels tremendously faster. I remember how difficult it was for my dad to get a book that talked about Yoruba culture in like in depth and breadth, right? There was a place, there is still a place here in Chicago in Hyde Park called Frontline Books. I live literally a block from there now, but what's wild is that was the only physical place where I ever saw like Yoruba terms, like in any text, right? And then they just had shelves and shelves of books. He used to have to order them via mail, again, pre-internet, right? No Amazon.
Right.
From Henrietta Press in New York, because there's a bookstore there that was just one of the, you know, places that you could get these texts. And then my dad had a rule that you couldn't take books out of the house for that reason, because he would never be able to replace them. So I think that information traveling, you know, at hyper speeds like it is now, obviously speeds up people's thinking, I think, in one perspective. I also think that given the style, you know, it's like the game of telephone, right? You're going to end up with a lot more versions of the same story because of how many more people are talking about it and how many more hands it's going through before you receive it, right?
What's the word you'd have for kind of like your mission on earth? Like, is there a term that you would say?
We just say destiny.
Destiny. Would that be the kind of the thread that would bind all of you together, is that pursuit of that you've committed to God, you have a mission, and that you're trying to discover that mission? Do you think that would survive in all the different sects you're referring to?
I would say yes. You know, obviously, I can't speak for all the other ones, but I would say that to say that, again, it's all a personal relationship. It's all, the community is a group of people that I have a responsibility to for my physical being, But my spiritual being does not require anyone else, right? It is really a relationship directly between myself and my destiny that I chose to come here. And the tools, the divination tools, are used to keep me in line with that destiny. So in some cases, I mean, you know, everything from dating to getting married to taking jobs to places to even travel. Like today, you know, I did a couple of check-ins just to see, like, you know, I have three or four options. I can take the metro, I could take the bus, I could, you know, call an Uber, I could call a friend. There's four or five different ways I could get here, but which one would be the most beneficial to me today? You know, that type of thing. It can get down to that level of nuance where you're choosing modes of travel for some people. Others may be a little bit more macro. And in Orun Ifa, every 5 days when you're doing your check-in with your destiny, you cast two letters. And it is one of these 16 on either side. So it's a total of 256 combinations. From that letter, you research what would be considered the experiences of other people who have lived and reported their experience under that letter. So you consult these different recorded stories and narratives of people who experience life under that combination. And it serves as a guide to keep an eye out for things, what's going on in the world. You know, when this was going on with me, I was having a lot of issues with my wife and a lot of issues with women. And so, you know, there's an oral tradition that has always been the foundation of this, but it's becoming more and more written down.
So I'm curious just about day-to-day life, where rubber meets the road, because you've talked about how your faith and this idea of destiny can influence the way you date or the way you choose your career. And I'm curious, how did your faith help you make sense of little things?
I have godmothers and godfathers who are way more like down to the micro scale of assessing things. My youthful practice would be if there was a major decision coming up and, you know, you go to your parents and it's like, hey, dad, you know, I either want to take this job over here or I want to quit my job and go out for the football team or whatever. He would pretty much always require that I get a reading. So I sit down, he does the divination, and then he interprets the letter to me, right? And then I can ask specific questions about these specific things.
How long is this process taking? Like, you guys sit down?
It's about a 90-minute process. Yeah, it starts out with a prayer. And
was he doing this because he was your dad or a priest or both?
Like, both.
But this is a priest thing?
Yeah, he was considered to be the chief, you know, in this area. And so, yeah, I had an in-home, he's called a Babalawo. The official name is a Babalawo. And it's a person who has been initiated to Ifa, which is the Oracle of Destinies. And this person has been given specific rights to cast divination on your behalf, because I have not been initiated to Ifa in that way, right?
My dad was the leader of my congregation for a time when I was a teenager. Yeah. So it's kind of like...
Yeah, it's rare, man.
It can be kind of annoying because it's kind of like you almost want spiritual guidance. And it's sometimes your dad being your dad could taint it or could make it really cool because your dad
knows you, man, and sees you. Yeah,
yeah.
So when I was a freshman in high school, I had been playing Pop Warner football in the neighborhood, you know, since I was six. All the coaches knew me. I'd gone to the camp over summer and the coach was basically like, you're going to be the starting guy, man. You're my guy.
Wow. What position did you want to do?
Oh, running back. I was like
running
4 foot.
You're fast.
I was like 5'2", though. That was really, I was quick, but I wasn't really fast, which I found out quickly. But in any case, you know, I love playing sports. I was shifty. I could catch. I was talented, you know, played all kind of other stuff. But this was what my life was about at that time. It was school and sports, you know. So he, of course, was like, well, let's take it to the mat. That's generally the phrase we use. And so I got the reading and the reading came back. No, you shouldn't play football. Hmm. And I was crushed, man, because yeah, this was my dream to be the next Barry Sanders.
So the idea is he's letting you know, is this in line with your destiny? So that's the point of being
exactly,
the reading. Okay, so
exactly.
So it's like you feel drawn to this thing, but I'm going to tell you if God has this in mind
basically
for you.
Yep.
And when he said that, you didn't feel like God was saying it to you?
No, of course not, man. I was staring my dad in the face and, okay, and I was looking at him, you know, like, come on, man. Like, how could this not be for me is what I'm thinking. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is all I've ever done. This is all I want to do. Y'all yeah, tell me follow my dreams. I can't follow my dreams and not play football, you know. So
can you get a second opinion?
You can. That's an interesting question. Okay. It is generally thought to be, I'm not going to say frowned upon because it's really not frowned upon. It's thought to be somewhat of a degradation, though, of the original reading, right? So the idea being you don't keep asking the same question until
right,
you get a yes,
I
right?
See.
Like that defeats the whole purpose, right? This is also the dude that feeds me,
yep,
takes me to school, buys my equipment. So if it really is him not wanting me to play, I'm just not going to play anyway. Right.
Right.
And so
it's expensive to play football.
Right. And so on top of that, though, if it's not him, if it's not him personally saying, I don't want you to play, and it really is, you know, a divine order communication that I shouldn't be playing, then I have to make do with that. Right. I have to figure out how to get through that until I get okay with it. Mm. And so, you know, I said, okay, my plan freshman year was I'm going to go to every practice. I'm going to work with the team. I'm going to learn all the plays so that next year I can play, right? Mm. And of course, that didn't happen. And I basically never played football in high school. And now, when I look back on that now, I was maybe 5'2", 90 pounds. I wrestled at 90 pounds my whole high school career, right? I graduated mm-hmm. high school at like 115 pounds. These dudes that I would have been playing against are three times my size, yeah. twice as fast as me, and are getting recruited by D1 schools, you know, to show off on me, right? So in real life, I wonder what my life would have looked like had I actually played football, right? Like what types of injuries might I have sustained? Mm-hmm. What type of time might I have wasted on something that would have probably left me without a full-time professional football career for all intents and purposes, right? So I think that it's not something that is always going to be clear in the beginning. I mean, there are a number of times where I've gone to the mat, things that I was just 100% sure were perfect for me, and it come up no. And that's when you find yourself in the, okay, so what am I missing here? And it does. It really pushes you to think through all of the meticulous elements and some of the larger picture things all at the same time.
Do you know what your destiny is?
I have been given the interpretation when I was initiated. You receive what is considered to be your destiny. It's something that you revisit, man. I've read this document maybe 200 times since I was 12.
I have a document too, by the way. This is so fascinating. It's called a patriarchal blessing that I got.
Interesting.
When I was a teenager.
Is it individual though? Does everybody get a different
one? It's individual. You go to the patriarch, who is the patriarch for a few congregations, and he puts his hands on your head and he basically...
Oh, this is similar.
Yeah, there's somebody transcribes it and gives it to you. And you're supposed to keep it close to you.
Maybe the actual ritual format looks different, but that's basically the process where an elder casts the divination and then someone records his interpretation and put it in a document.
How long is yours?
It's only, what, 2 pages, maybe 3 pages.
Mine's a page and a half.
It's not designed to be super long. It's basically designed to give you the area that you will probably find the most success in. It's not super specific, like you should go into banking, right? But right. It will say something like, you will find yourself most satisfied if you're involved in finances and things like that, right?
Yeah.
It identifies the things that I'm probably going to struggle the most with, which, you know, I tell people all the time, I don't know how much of any religious perspective or cultural perspective is magic, or even for me, just the simple fact of checking in at those levels and thinking that directly about my decisions in life, things that I want out of life, the things that I may be struggling with in life. Just the direct check-in is enough for me in a lot of ways, man, because like I said, I see these things differently over the course of time. When I revisit that document, elements of it mean something totally different to me now than it meant when I was 15.
What's like a phrase that's turned out to be really true?
There's something in there where he says, you're going to always want to be on stage, man. Mm. You're always going to want to be in the spotlight. You're always going to want to jump up and be there. And you're going to find that it's not for you, that you are better off behind the scenes, that you're better off not in the front. It's crazy because my mom's a huge like social performer and storyteller and jazz singer, and like every human being in the world who meets my mom is my mom's new best friend, right? And my dad's in theater. So I was raised on stage, like literally. We didn't go to like babysitters. We just went to rehearsals, right? So my comfort with the stage, my comfort with being on it, and the excitement and the enjoyment I get. Yeah, I've always wanted to be on stage, but my current profession now, I'm a production manager, which is all the behind the scenes, right? Uh-huh. I do all the scheduling, all of the logistics and all of that. And then at the end of the show, nobody ever knows it was me that put this whole thing together. You know what I mean? So, but I have found that to be true in the instances where I have not fought the impulse to take the stage and be the person in charge. I have experienced not necessarily failure, but certainly not the reward and the excitement that I initially thought I would. And two, the series of expectations that comes with that lifestyle that you have to be on 24 hours. Being thrust into those aspects of that life are things that definitely are not something I'm interested in, right? I don't know how much of it was kind of internalized in me when he said it, but as I've gone through life, I've always kind of been the guy that's like, you know what, man, I'd rather everybody know my name and not know who I am. Like, I want them to see my name on checks and stuff all in movie credits and things all over the world and still not know who I am.
Thanks to Makinde Alidapo for joining us on Preach. This show is a production of KUER and PRX. We have a newsletter. Find the sign-up link at preachpod.org and check us out on Twitter. We're at preachpod. This show is produced by me, Lee Hale, along with Trisha Bobita and Roddy Nickpour. Our digital producer is Chelsea Naughton, and our executive producer is Joel Meyer. Preach is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. If you love the show, please tell a friend and spread the word. It also helps us out if you leave us stars and a review on Apple Podcasts. Like Yael Pedroza, who said, "I'm a non-religious person raised by a Jewish father and a Catholic mother, and I really, really enjoy listening to your podcast." Thanks, Yael, and thank you for listening. I'm Lee Hale. We'll be back next week. I taught ninth grade for a hot second. And then I switched over to journalism. So those who can't teach report, I say.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, man. From PRX.